I thought I would acquaint you just a little bit with my wife and where she's from. We were just recently out to Central Oregon, and so this is about 10 miles from where Diane grew up. She is from Silver Lake, Oregon, and this is Fort Rock, and obviously it's a volcanic vent. I don't know that this picture was taken from the church that her parents attended, but you could take this picture just out the window of that church looking north. I'm going to show you now where this is. Here's a map of Oregon, and then Fort Rock. Okay, I guess I've got a button I can... Fort Rock is right there, and Silver Lake with the big star is there. Now, Silver Lake is rather remote, as you can see. If you want to go to a bank, you need to drive 80 miles up to Bend. This is very...
Lapine would
well, actually, it's, things have grown. Lapine now has a bank, too, on the way. Diane's brother went to high school in Bend, so he would ride the bus on Monday morning.
No, he lived there.
Okay.
Yeah.
He didn't come home weekends?
No.
You did. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Now I learned something new. After 38 years, I learned something I didn't know. he was going to high school 80 miles away, and Diane decided to stay closer to home. So she went down to high school down, actually, here at Paisley. So she had a 50-mile ride, and so she would... be home on weekends and then take off for school on Monday morning, come home on the bus Friday afternoon. So for us to live out in Bennett with 2,000 people, you know, that's really big city living. I mean, we met actually on the coast of Oregon down here at Brookings, 3,000 population. Then I took her to the big city, took her to Minneapolis, and Dallas, and then the Orange County, California metropolis, and so on and so forth. You might wonder, what does all of this have to do with John chapter 4? Well, since Silver Lake is very remote, there's no doctor. And Diane's mother was a registered nurse. So next door to their house was parked the ambulance. And Diane's father would drive the ambulance into Bend, and Diane's mother would do the primary medical care until they could get a person to the hospital. So they had people come in the middle of the night barging into the house wanting medical attention because of an emergency situation. That's something that Diane grew up with. As we look at John chapter 4, there was no CareFlight. CareFlight helipad is only two blocks away from where Diane grew up. They didn't have any such thing. They didn't have ambulances. The Father came to have Jesus come in order to heal his son. His son was on the verge of death. What I'd like to do, though, to set this up, is let's now look at the purpose statement for the Gospel of John. John gives his purpose statement for the book at the very end. The end of John chapter 20, we have verses 30 and 31 in chapter 20. Thus also Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these, and he focuses on eight signs, are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. This makes John's gospel unique. It is the only book of the New Testament that addresses unbelievers. Every other book in the New Testament is written to believers. And I have a personal definition for what an unbeliever is. An unbeliever is a professional at missing the point. They have devoted their entire life to missing it. So if the message that we have, and it's coming from our words, we can easily continue that trend of saying things just a little too deep, a little too complicated for them to catch on. Nice thing about the Gospel of John is that what Isaiah 55 tells us, that God's word does not return to him void without accomplishing what he is sent it to do, applies to this book. This book was written so that the unbeliever could know how to have everlasting life as a gift simply by believing Jesus Christ for it. There are two words I would like for you to notice as you look at this text. You see the word you here and here. John has identified his readers as ones who have not yet believed and therefore do not yet have life. And so this is where he identifies the readership. That tells us why this is the book that we want to distribute to unbelievers. Now, I mentioned that there are eight signs in this book. Let's review those. The last time we got together, we looked at chapter 2, 1 through 12, which was Jesus' first sign in this book. We are today going to look at the second sign, where he healed a royal official's son from afar. They're actually 30 miles away from the son at the time that the healing occurred. Next time we will look at the beginning of John chapter 5, where he healed a man who had been lame for 38 years. In chapter 6, there are two signs. He fed 5,000 men plus women and children, and then he teleported the boat after walking on the sea. Now, most people think that the sign there is walking on the sea, but in John's Gospel, signs are defined as a miracle that was announced before it happened. Jesus always speaks. And the very last verse of that section, verse 21, mentions that he transported the boat immediately to its destination. They had been rowing all night, clear until 3 o'clock in the morning from sunset, and they only got halfway across the sea. Jesus immediately transported them to Capernaum. Then we have in chapter 9, Jesus healing the man who was born blind, and in chapter 11, raising Lazarus from the dead. The first portion of the book, chapters 1 through 12, looks at 7 signs, but those 7 signs are balanced by one supreme sign. It was pre-announced in John chapter 2, and then there are 4 verifications that he rose after his raising from the cross. He died on the cross, was buried, and he rose, but then there are 4 confirmations of his rising. 4 separate appearances that are given in John chapters 20 and 21. John has emphasized the cross and resurrection tremendously by pre-announcing it back in chapter 2, then devoting 2 chapters to the occurrence of the cross plus the resurrection. It's not 2 signs. Cross and resurrection are 1 sign. Let's take a look. Go back to John chapter 2, and we'll look at verses 18 through 22. This is New Bible, so it's taking a little work to get pages reopened. John chapter 2. Every time I see the word Jew in the Gospel of John, I will always translate it Judean. The term is Eudaios, and in the context of John's Gospel, it always means Judean. It never means Jew. It's a word like our word Yankee. If someone in Mississippi says Yankee, go home, they're looking at, are you from north of Mason-Dixon line? But if someone in Iran says it, they have a completely different meaning. And the word Eudaios can be Jew in certain contexts, or it can be Judean in others. And in John's Gospel, it's always Judean. I brought with me a thesis that a student of mine did on that topic, an excellent thesis, I might add. Okay, so in verse 18, the Judeans answered and said to him, "What sign do you show us, since you do these things?" This is after the first temple cleansing. And they're saying, what gives you the right to do this? Show us a sign from God that demonstrates that you have the authority to chase all these people out of the temple. So Jesus answers, what sign? He says, destroy this sanctuary. If your translation says temple, it's actually a more specific word. It would be a word referring to the Holy of Holies and the holy place. So destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Notice when you look down at verse 21, he was speaking of the sanctuary of his body. He was predicting the cross and the resurrection as the ultimate sign verifying his right to cleanse the temple. Now Jesus was not doing bait and switch, because verse 23 tells us that he did many signs while he was there at the feast. And Nicodemus's first words to Jesus in 3:2 also mention that he has done many signs. But Jesus is saying the cross and the resurrection are the ultimate verifying sign. John gives a lot of attention to it with pre-announcement, then chapters 19 and 20 devoted to the cross and resurrection, and 20 and 21 then looking at four post-resurrection appearances. So, with that as background for the book, this book being a book that uses signs to verify that Jesus is the life-giving Messiah who gives everlasting life to those who simply believe him for it. So now let's set up a little bit of background for our passage. If we look at John chapter 3, verse 22, this is right after Jesus leaves Jerusalem, after the Feast of Passover. And there he goes out into the Judean wilderness, and as you can see, it's an area that looks a little bit like Silver Lake, Oregon. It's on the dry side. And if you didn't have the Jordan River, it would be all dry. And so Jesus is baptizing out in the Judean wilderness. Verse 22 of John 3. After these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the, your translations usually will say, land of Judea. More literally, the Greek says the Judean countryside. And so Judean is used as an adjective, and it's a little different construction than is normally translated. And there he remained with them and baptized. Let's skip down to chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, then he departed. And we'll get into why it was that his popularity led to him leaving Judea. That will actually set up some things for our passage. There are several results of Jesus having this ministry and of having large numbers of people gathering to him. The first thing is that it upset John the Baptist's own disciples who were with him. Look at 3:26. And I would take it that it would be John's disciples, came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and a couple of people are coming to him." If your Bible reads that way, I suggest getting a new one. All are coming to him. They are upset. They're saying, "You gave him a recommendation, and look at what he's done with it. He's destroyed your ministry. You've shrunk. He's grown, and you should be angry at him. You need to go and talk to Jesus and tell him what's the right way of repaying you." And this is clearly not it. John has been given an opportunity to badmouth Jesus, but instead He's trying to direct his disciples towards Jesus, as is his normal policy. John the Baptist regarded success as a shrinking ministry. The more people that left him and started following Jesus, the better. And so notice, we'll just look at a few things. In verse 27, John answered, "A man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him." And he goes on throughout the rest of the chapter to direct their attention to Jesus. And he's not complaining at all that his ministry has gotten smaller and Jesus has grown. This has actually taken place in a very short period of time. I would say that John 4, 1 occurs less than 6 weeks following Passover. That's an unusual dating for it, but the temperatures would have been so hot down in the area where John had baptized Jesus that the crowds wouldn't have been coming anymore. And so everything within this passage points to it's a very short period of time. Jesus' ministry has eclipsed John suddenly. But then in 4:1, this brought unwanted attention from the Pharisees. And so they were noticing, they had given trouble to John the Baptist in John 1, but now that Jesus' ministry has gotten bigger than John's, they're going to be focusing all their attention towards Jesus. He wants to go up north to Galilee, where there is going to be less concentrated opposition. So he wants to go north. The country of Israel is divided into Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. Jesus is wanting to go north to Galilee. That's announced in 4:1 and 2. But we have to ask a question here at this point that will be very important. What did Jesus regard as his homeland? Did he regard Galilee as his homeland, which is where he grew up and where he lived most of his life? Or did he regard Judea, the southern part of the country, as his homeland?
He's the line of Judah. It has to be Judah.
Yeah, Judah is it, and within the passage that's going to follow that will introduce our passage, it becomes very apparent that it was because of the Pharisees and their opposition that Jesus attributes to himself what he had said of a prophet is not without honor except in his home country. Yeah, it's actually a little more vague rather than town. It's a little broader for the term, but that's the idea.
Didn't he go to, or his parents originally settled up north as a byproduct of having fled to Egypt originally, and then having come back, still being concerned about the prosecution and persecution of Herod?
Sure, very much so. When we look at Luke, though, we find out that they lived in Nazareth before they went down to Bethlehem for the birth of Jesus. Mm. So that was a return to Nazareth. Because Archelaus, one of the sons of Herod, was down in the south, so they were very nervous about going south. They returned up north. You'll notice that one town that I didn't mark here is Sepphoris. Sepphoris was a boom town at the time of the birth of Jesus. Herod the Great made it into what Josephus called the crown jewel of Galilee. And so there are many stupendous works that still survive that are there, but it was his capital. It was a Gentile town, but it's very likely that Joseph and other artisans were actually working to help build Sepphoris. And so there was quite a bit of economic opportunity, and as a result, there was a major Judean influx into Galilee because of the work opportunities there at Sepphoris. Now, the events of the passage that we are going to be looking at will be Capernaum is where the man's son is, and Cana, which is where the wedding had been in John chapter 2, is where Jesus will be when the royal official approaches him. So, let's start our passage. John chapter 4, verse 43. Jesus has stopped in Sychar in Samaria, and he met the Samaritan woman at the well, and because of the reception that he received there, he stayed for an additional 2 days, and many people from that small town believed in him. And so now it says in verse 43, now after the 2 days, he departed from there and went to Galilee. So he continued going a little bit further north up into Galilee. In verse 44, this is looking retrospectively back at John chapter 4, verse 3, where Jesus had left Judea for Galilee because a prophet lacks honor in his homeland. Verse 44, for Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country or his own region. Notice that he had left Judea back, if you look back at verse 3 of chapter 4, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee, but he needed to go through Samaria. He took the cool route. If he had gone down along the Jordan River, it would have been much hotter. But of course, he also had a divine appointment to meet with the Samaritan woman and the people of the town. So when it says that he needed to go through there, I think it's mainly focusing on the divine appointment. I think that his disciples had been through Samaria. It's often thought that they had not, because when people read Josephus, Josephus says that the Judeans didn't go through Samaria. But in that same context, he said that the Galileans regularly did. And all of Jesus' disciples seem to have been Galilean, and that's going to be important, because in the Gospel of John, certain features are very Galilean in nature, even the way that they told time. And it's going to have an impact at various points within the book. So Jesus' homeland would be the place of his birth. His parents were Judean. And furthermore, if you remember the conversation that Jesus had with his half-brothers in John chapter 7, they wanted him to go to Judea. They wanted him to go down to Judea, to Jerusalem, because they themselves regarded Galilee as a backwater. John chapter 7 is very interesting. At the beginning, the conversation that Jesus has with his half-brothers. Now, throughout John's gospel, people are saying to Jesus that he's a Galilean. Now, we know, of course, that he was born in Bethlehem, but he ultimately regards his origin as from above. And constantly in the Gospel of John, he says that he is from above. And I'd like to show you a verse that I think should be punctuated as a question mark in John chapter 7. When Jesus is having a discussion in Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles, in verse 28, then Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple, saying, and this is quoted as punctuated here as though they were statements, but I believe it's questions. I think it should be, do you indeed know me, and do you know where I am from? And so they are saying that he's a Galilean, and they don't really know where he is from. he's always saying either from Bethlehem, from Judea, or ultimately from heaven. So, he's left, and he was dishonored by the Pharisees. When they noticed that his ministry was growing rapidly, Jesus decided that it was time to leave. I think that it was much easier for him to train up his disciples up north. So I've often referred to the Gospel of John is showing Jesus on vacation. He spent a week at a time down in Jerusalem. Now, that wasn't much of a vacation because he always was hounded by all of the religious leaders as he went down there. But now in verse 45, we see the Galilean... The Galileans received him because they saw all, that is, the signs that he did in Jerusalem at the Passover. So in verse 45, John 4, verse 45. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they also had gone to the feast. In particular, we have Galileans that had been down in John chapter 2 to the Passover feast and saw all the signs that he had done there. Yes.
Could you give us a little context as to why the Jewish people of that day put so much faith and trust and interest in the concept of the word that we're reading as signs? I know there's a lot in the Old Testament, but do you see something is that overarching that has held
sure.
their whole culture from the beginning all the way from the burning bush through?
Well, let's turn to Deuteronomy 18.
Okay.
First one of these sessions, I spent some time in Deuteronomy 18. The passage tells us, as we consider the latter portion of that chapter, starting at verse 15, God is going to raise up a prophet like Moses. And Israel is going to be responsible to heed what he says. But now the big question becomes, how would Israel recognize him? How would they recognize the prophet like Moses? It's given to us in a negative form rather than a positive. Starting in verse 21, and if you say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? So it's recognizing the false prophet and by elimination recognizing the true prophet. When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. I have a term, or my understanding is that a sign is a short-term prophecy. So a prophecy is made, something is said, and then it is done. It happens quickly enough that the people are able to assess, okay, there are these series of short-term prophecies, and they occur. John's Gospel calls those signs.
Would, like, fire coming down from heaven when Elijah did that, did they consider that a sign, or a sign only a spoken word?
There were signs. There were signs of prophets in general, but this is ultimately looking for the prophet who would be the most like Moses. Let's go to Acts chapter 3, and we see Peter applying this passage from Deuteronomy 18 to Jesus. Acts 3, starting at verse 22. For Moses truly said to the fathers, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren, and him you shall hear in all things whatever he says to you. and shall be that every soul who will not hear that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. Yes, and all the prophets, from Samuel and those who follow, the rest of the prophets, as many as have spoken, have also foretold these days. And Jesus is the ultimate one who is the most like Moses. The way that he resembled Moses that's different from all the other prophets, Moses had a close relationship with the Lord. And we're told by the Old Testament when Miriam and Aaron challenged him at one point, the Lord made it very clear, I speak to Moses directly. Every other prophet gets their information in a more indirect way. But Jesus has an even more direct connection with the Father than Moses could have ever dreamed of. So he is the prophet who is the most like Moses, but exceeds Moses tremendously. And so Deuteronomy 18, though, sets the foundation for the signs. This is what John is going back to, is that very
idea. That's why, yes, they asked him, they did inquire of him and say, are you the prophet?
Absolutely. Yeah. The questions would revolve around who do you claim to be, and then do you have the signs that would verify who you say you are? And John is showing that Jesus meets the qualification. Now, I think that the wording of seeing a sign is significant in John's gospel. And I, pardon the pun, that the sign is significant. Seeing a sign is significant. I've noticed that it says here in this verse, in John chapter 4, that they saw, having seen all the things that he did in Jerusalem. Now let's turn back to John chapter 2, where we'll see similar wording. In John chapter 2, verse 23, it says that many people believed in him when they saw the signs which he did. Now, you notice verse 24, where it says that he did not entrust himself to them. Many people incorrectly assume that they believed without getting everlasting life. However, it doesn't say anything like that. When one believes in Jesus Christ, that Jesus is the Christ, in the way that John is aiming, they have everlasting life. Some have challenged, well, sign faith, is that really appropriate? But let's think back to the purpose statement of John. The signs were given so that people would believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing, have life in his name. Let's also think about the very fact that John, the only times that Jesus ever criticized people for asking for a sign was if he had given a sign and they had rejected it, and then they said, could you show us another one? Now that happened in Matthew 12, and I would say that's the criteria upon which Jesus would castigate people for asking for a sign if they had rejected one that was given. But now, as you look at John 2:24, when it says that he did not entrust himself to them, well, I think this is a perfectly good illustration. I am sure that this little boy is very lovable. I don't know who he is, but I'm sure that he's a very special little boy. But would you entrust your car to him? Would you ride in the back seat and say, could you drive me to church? I don't think so. In John's gospel, the concept of Jesus entrusting himself to his disciples, he didn't entrust himself to them until the last discourse. They were still being trained up. And you have brand new believers that have just believed in him in verse 23. Of course he's not going to entrust himself to them. That doesn't mean that they didn't have everlasting life. They did. And I actually believe that some of the Galileans were among that crowd. But I'd like for you to notice a verse in John chapter 6 that I made note of in the notes. We have a group of people that I call the kingmakers in John 6:26 or 6:25 that approached Jesus. And Jesus addresses them and he said, "Amen, amen." That's a more literal rendering. "I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." They were looking at the horizontal level. They saw food. They ate, they were satisfied. And they said, "We want more food." But seeing a sign is seeing the vertical significance of who Jesus is. And I would take it, whenever John uses the phrase "seeing a sign," he's not talking about just seeing that something unusual has happened. But they are seeing it. They're perceiving that it is indeed a sign by God. And it is verifying who Jesus is. Now notice, in John chapter 4, what do we have? We have these people having seen all that Jesus did in Jerusalem. They welcomed him. They welcomed him because they indeed recognized that there's something very special about Jesus. And lo and behold, we have a man that's going to travel 30 miles to come to see him because he has perceived that Jesus can do something for his son. I would take it that these people are among those that were referred to in John 2:23 that believed because they saw the signs that Jesus did at the feast. So now, we're told in the next verse that Jesus was in Cana of Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And so you notice it is a hilly region, and it turns out that it's about 500 feet in elevation higher than the area of Capernaum. Now there's going to be a royal official who is going to come from Capernaum in order to, whose son is sick, and he wants for his son to be healed. So notice now in verse 46b, certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum is introduced. So let's look at where Capernaum is in relation. It's about a 500-foot rise in elevation. Actually, 500 meters. I'm sorry, I said feet. I meant meters. And that to go from Capernaum, which would be at this elevation, to go to Cana here. And so Capernaum is here, and the man has traveled up to Cana, which would be about 30 miles and going up about 500 meters or a little over 1,500 feet. And so let's get a couple of views. This is looking down from the horns of Hattim into the vicinity of Capernaum. You can see there's a significant drop there as you're approaching the Sea of Galilee. Let's back up a little further, and pull in a little closer, and we get another view looking down through the horns of Hattim. So again, you can change this, it's meters here on the notes. It would be about one day by horseback to go 30 miles. I wouldn't be surprised if he brought some extra horses along so that he'd have horses that hadn't been carrying him in order to bring Jesus. He's wanting to get Jesus there as quickly as possible. I mean, this is time for care flight, ambulance service there in Silver Lake. I mean, the idea is let's get Jesus out there quickly so that Jesus can put his hands upon the son and heal him. Who knows? This official may have been down in Jerusalem at the time of the feast. Now, I do argue that he is Jewish because of what occurs when Jesus answers the man. The statement that Jesus makes, I would point out to him being Jewish. Notice he says, unless y'all see signs and wonders, y'all by no means will believe. He is not rebuking them. And to use our plural, I did live in Dallas for 14 years. So I think it's better than what the Aussies always were telling me that I should say. They said, you should say, use guys. I just stay with y'all. This is pointing to the expectation that the Messiah would do signs. And Jesus is not rebuking them for seeking signs, because God had put that out as an expectation for the Messiah. Now the question becomes, how is it that this man knows that Jesus is going to be in Cana? How does he know where to come? Why didn't he just go to Nazareth, where Jesus seems to have headquartered up until this point, the place of his upbringing? I would suspect that it's because this man not only knows who Jesus is, perhaps because he had been down in Jerusalem, but he knows others who know where Jesus would be and would be able to ask. And so it is not just casual interest that is being indicated here. This man is keeping tabs on where Jesus is. He knows exactly where to come to find him. Now in verse 47, the royal official begs for Jesus to heal his son. It says that he implored him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. It turns out he has a sickness and he's running a high fever within the context here. I would say because of 1 Corinthians 1:22 that verse 48 is pointing to this man being Jewish, so he would be of the Herodian dynasty rather than a Roman. And we've already talked about Deuteronomy 18, so I won't cover that at this point. Let's go to verse 49. The nobleman said to him, "Sir," I would prefer to translate it "Lord." All the indications are he knows that Jesus is the Messiah. He already understands that. So he fully expects that Jesus is going to be able to heal his son. So, "Lord, come down before my child dies." Jesus gives him a very simple answer in verse 58. Jesus said to him, "Go your way, your son lives." Signs were meant to lead to belief in Jesus as the life-giving Messiah, because signs proved him to be the greater than Moses, prophet like Moses. And the 1 Corinthians passage, I obviously put this slide in wrong order when I marked this. But Jesus told him to go his way. Three times in this passage it's going to say, "Your son or your child lives." Notice what Jesus says here in verse 50, "Your son lives." Then his servants at the end of verse 51 said, "Your son lives." And then the father knows in verse 53 that it was at the same time that he was healed as when Jesus said, "Your son lives." There's a great emphasis on the word "live" throughout the Gospel of John. I would prefer to render it, "Your son lives." But Jesus has not expressed there, "Your son is well." So we're told now that the man believed what Jesus said after Jesus has told him, "Go your way, your son lives." So in verse 50b, the man believed Jesus' word and he left. He didn't keep pestering Jesus, "You've got to come down. You've got to come. You can't Just send me home. I've got to have you come with me. No. Jesus said, go your way. Your son lives. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he went his way. I would say to those who overanalyze this passage, some people will say, oh, he exercised head faith because later on in the passage he believes again. Do you notice that? Look down at verse 53. He himself believed, and his whole household. And you have people touting the nonsense that he had the wrong kind of faith to start with. I would say instead the solution is, Jesus spoke somewhat vaguely, and so he believed what he thought Jesus meant the first time, but later he came to understand that Jesus' words went beyond what he had thought that they meant. But he believed and he went his way, and he even got a motel that night. Did you know that? The passage tells us that he got a motel that night, if we keep looking. So he left. We won't go into the details there on types of objects that belief takes. But notice in verse 51, he's going down the road and his servants come up the road and they meet him. As he was now going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, your son lives. So he's going down, the servants come up, they meet, and they make the announcement. So that raises a question in his mind in verse 52a. He inquired of them the hour when he got better. But the Greek word doesn't mean total healing. It's the start of healing. He's asking, when did he start getting better? When did you see a change? Because notice, they've made an ambiguous statement. Your son lives. They haven't said, your son is all better. But he's alive. He's past the crisis. He's not at the point of death. And so he immediately says, well, when did he start getting better? And their answer was one that said that instead there was a complete recovery. Now, got the ambulance there. Obviously, slightly wrong place that I marked it, but he was in a hurry for Jesus to come. Jesus didn't need to come. So then he asked the question, when did he start getting better? And they told him that the fever vanished the previous day at 1 o'clock. They said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, fever left him. Notice, he got a motel. And people say he only had head faith. What nonsense. By the way, I don't believe there is such a concept of head faith versus heart faith. It just doesn't exist. It's a matter of we either believe something or we do not believe it. The question is the content of the faith that we believe, is it a sufficient content that we have believed? And it's a complete sidetrack for people to go down that trail. Yes, Bob?
You mentioned earlier that the Galileans had a different way of looking at time. Can you explain the seventh hour?
We're getting in there.
Okay.
We're right there. So Galileans started their time at daybreak. Okay. Now, this is a different type of a sundial than you may have seen before. This one is at Ephesus. There's another one in Israel, but it had that peg that's up here broken off, so you couldn't see it. Notice the shadow that it's making that's cast down here. For anyone here that knows Greek, although this was this is from the 3rd century A.D., it has a very, very old form of the Greek alphabet, because this particular letter right here, the digamma, had dropped out of the Greek alphabet before the time of the New Testament. So it's really interesting that it's there. But there are 12 hours that are set there, and Jesus in John chapter 11, verse 9 says, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Galileans told their time starting at sunrise. It's an interesting thing when you use a sundial for the actual time. If you have the spacing there the same per each hour, notice that when you're looking at December 21st, as opposed to June 21st, the length of an hour is going to be different. But it still divides up into 12 hours over the course of a day. But 12 hours of daylight. Galileans told time starting at daylight. Judeans told time starting at sunset. And it affects certain things. And so we have a number of passages in John. John chapter 1, verse 39 speaks about the 10th hour, and that's 4 p.m. And the question they ask when you look at context, it's an afternoon question, not a morning question. 4:6, about the 6th hour, as in 1914. And here we have 7th hour, this is 1 p.m. 6 o'clock would be normally the approximate sunrise, and so then the hours work out accordingly. So notice then it is that Jesus knew that it took place at the very hour that Jesus said, your son lives. He had initially understood him to say, okay, he's living. The crisis has passed. But now he has a greater content of faith because he realizes right when Jesus said, your son lives, there was an instantaneous healing over a 30-mile distance. Now, they didn't have Rolex watches, so that's why it doesn't say the very second, but it's the hour. That was as close as they were able to tell time. And what we have as a result of this in verse 53b is that the father believed the greater content, and so did his whole household. And he himself believed, and his whole household. They didn't just believe that the son lives. They were believing in Jesus Christ as the giver of life. They have come to understand the greater truth as they've had opportunity to reflect upon what Jesus did from a distance. Then we're told this is the second sign that Jesus did after coming out of Judea into Galilee. The first sign was recorded for us back in John chapter 2. And that sign was the first sign that was done after Jesus started accumulating disciples. Why is it so important that Jesus needed to have accumulated disciples? This is a book of evidence. Notice, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples. John is giving signs that the rest of the disciples could attest to. This was meant to stand up in a court of law. The book of John is a book of evidence. If you notice the words witness, testimony, and testify, they also, along with the word believe, show up many times in this book. Let's now take a look at John 21:24. That's the next to the last verse of this book. And it is one of the reasons that I hold to a very early date for the Gospel of John. Most people date John in the 90s. I date John in the 30s. I believe it was very possibly the first book of the New Testament written. And let's look at one of the pieces of evidence, John 21:24. This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things. And we. And the question is, who are the we?
Disciples.
The disciples. We know that his testimony is true. Think back to John chapter 1, verse 14. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. The word that is used is skenao, and it is intentionally a word that resembles a Hebrew word. Skenao in Greek means to dwell in a tent. And it has the same consonantal value as shakane, the Hebrew word to dwell in a tent. Do you remember what the glory that dwelt in a tent was called in the Old Testament? Shekinah. It literally is the tent glory. And so now, in 1:14, the word became flesh and tabernacled, dwelt in a tent, encamped among us. And we beheld his doxa, his glory. Glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Jesus was revealing his Shekinah glory. And interestingly enough, the first sign that Jesus did in John 2 of turning water to wine, we are told as a result of that, says, this beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory. He showed forth his Shekinah glory by doing sign. And his disciples believed in him. Belief is the proper response to signs because they showed who he was. We have a book here that's designed for the unbeliever that we are able to say it is attested to by the disciples. We, the disciples, know that John's testimony is true. My sense is that when the Gospel of John went out accompanying apostles. So that someone could say, well, hey, Peter, I don't understand this passage. Peter could say, well, it happened exactly as John said it. Let me explain. It was a book that was designed to stand up in a court of law. It was designed to prove by the testimony of many witnesses the incontrovertible truth that Jesus is the life-giving Messiah to all who simply believe him for it.